Hi, I'm Deke Antrim, and this is Sidetracked, a podcast for movie lovers. On this episode, I'm chatting with Master Steadicam operator Larry McConkey as he helps me break down a sampling of his most important works. In the first half of the podcast, we cover his collaborations with director Brian De Palma, then we transition into the work he's done for Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Spike Lee, and we end on Quentin Tarantino. From pre-production to execution, this is a transparent peek behind the scenes of what it takes for an expert camera operator like Larry to complete his insane shots. As always, we speak our minds here in Sidetracked, and there are major spoilers ahead. You have been warned. My guest today has revolutionized the art of Steadicam and movement in films and television. He's taken a small break from his busy schedule to chat with me on Sidetracked. Welcome to the show, Larry McConkey.
Thank you, Dean.
How you doing today?
Good. Kind of relaxed. See if I can get myself up to thinking and talking because I'm here just zoning out with the waves and mostly beautiful weather here.
Right.
And like doing nothing.
You deserve it.
For some pickleball. My wife and I have been.
That's huge down in Florida. Yeah. Before we dive into some of your more iconic shots and collaborations with amazing directors, can you give us a little history on how you got into the world of camera movement?
Yeah. How did I? It started when I had to make up credits. I dropped out of math at Cornell University. It got boring. I used to be a whiz at it, but then I couldn't see the point of it, and I needed to make up credits. And I what would be an easy course to take? And there was one offered in filmmaking there. So I thought, yeah, sure. My whole career path, as I'm sure you hear anybody, they all have different ways, was just picking up cameras and playing with them and starting to edit them. And eventually, after going through Cornell University, getting the first and only independent film major, which is a whole other discussion, but I got that, and then followed my first wife from Ithaca, where Cornell was, to Philadelphia, where she was in a PhD program. And I didn't know quite what to do. I'd go around and see if I get a job in filmmaking. But when I told them I had a degree, they was like, yeah, thanks, kid. Never mind. So I discovered that was a liability. I took a year just working jobs doing radio control model airplane, which is a huge passion of mine for a while. Ended up, by the way, putting cameras in those radio control model airplanes and eventually a radio control model helicopter, which was a natural segue into Garrett with Skycam.
Yeah.
But that's later. I finally decided to go into Temple University. They had a film program. I mean, if no one will hire me to shoot, well, maybe I go back to school. So got a position as a teaching assistant and didn't really have to pay for that. So that was cool. And I met several people, and this is key, with me in the program who all became as first good friends, but then they became the directors for films I made after I left that program. And that's the way I got into it, working for my good friends, shooting documentaries primarily, and some industrial, some whatever. They all went into different directions. Mm-hmm. And then needed to actually make a living somehow, because you can't make a living shooting documentaries. So I started working TV news in Philadelphia, shooting film. It takes a while to get it processed and developed, and not for TV news. So I would shoot something, and about 2 hours later, I could see it. And then sometimes I would actually be editing my own footage. So what a great way to learn. Somebody was paying for my education. I would try anything and everything. There were no rules, you know, make sure the reporter's in frame and focused if you have a reporter. But I learned that way and didn't get into features or anything. I hadn't even necessarily thought about it. I was just trying to make great shots. And for me, it was only handheld. So it was, how do I get the best possible handheld movement, which I'm sure you'll have, anybody you talk to will claim they're the best handheld cameraman in the world. I was too. And I remember trying at one point, shooting 100 feet of film, just trying to walk with the camera in some way that would emulate the human vision. I studied myself. You'd lock on something. Your brain and your eyes would make that static. And other things would move in relation to it. But there was at least one part of your vision that would be fixed. So I started figuring out how to walk and take steps and tilt, and mostly tilting in sync. After hours and hours and hours, I finally got about 6 seconds of like, shit, that's fucking awesome. But not efficient way to shoot. in any case, I was on my way to trying to figure out how you could move the camera portably, not with a dolly. I didn't know what a dolly was at that point. So that was when Bound for Glory popped up in the movie theater. So that was it. As soon as I saw that shot, nice crane shot, and then it started moving through the crowd,
right.
I was like, oh my God. I don't know how many of us had that, but for me, it was like, whoever did that, thank you, because that was made for me. I need that. What is it? And at that point, Garrett had a, I didn't know him. I was living in Philadelphia, so was he. I had no idea.
Garrett Brown is the inventor of the Steadicam.
Did anybody not know that? Yes, he did.
You never know. First timers. But so Garrett Brown invented the Steadicam and lived in Philadelphia also.
Yes, he did, and I had no idea. I just knew I needed that, and I figured out somehow it was called a Steadicam, and then where do I get one? And the only place within my area was one place, CameraMark, New York City, rented them. And Garrett had the notion, I learned since, that really it would be like any other filmmaking tool. You just go and rent one when you need it. And for him, it was like riding a bike. What's the big deal? Right. You learn a little bit and then you're done, which couldn't be further from the truth. It's more like a unicycle.
Right.
That isn't so easy to just get up and ride. Mm-hmm. But for him, it was like natural. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, it was not so natural. And I remember this is a great way to learn. They told us, it was my friend, Chris Wilkinson, who went on to become a great screenwriter. But back then, he was one of the people I worked with. He was my director for, and we both were just thrilled beyond belief about this thing. So we went together to CameraMark. How do we work it? I said, well, yeah, you strap the thing up. They really didn't know. Strap the thing on, you put the arm here. So go in this little office here. We're going to close the door. We'll leave you in there. I mean, it's pretty tight. So that way, if you fall over, you won't get hurt too bad. And after like 10, 15 minutes, knock on the door. Okay, well, I think we got it. So then they let us out and let us walk around the, you know, larger floor area.
Right.
I said, okay, looks like you can do it. So yeah, go ahead. You can rent it. That was it.
That was your training.
And that was my training. So anyway, we got back to Philadelphia and stayed up all night in studio trying to figure out how to do it. We'd alternate. You know, one would be the subject and one would be the operator, back and forth all night long. The early morning's hour. And then finally, Chris had said, well, yeah, okay. So realistically, I guess you need to be able the one to operate because I'm directing. So, okay, you can do it. And similar to my experience with still photography, I figured that at a roll of 36 exposure, if I could get one picture that was like good, that was great. Same thing with Steadicam at the beginning, 36 tries at a shot. And if I finally got one that worked, yes. So that's how I got started in it. And then it became the way I would shoot documentaries. So I would always have the Steadicam, and I mean like really ready to go. I own my own film camera. I set it all up so I could just snap it into the Steadicam. It was all just seat belted into the back seat of my car. And whenever we needed a Steadicam, we'd just pop it on, put it on, and away we went.
All right. If you're ready, let's begin with Brian De Palma and his director of photography, Stephen Burham, which is one of your longer running collaborations. I'm a huge De Palma fan, and it's because he is so visual. He uses split diopter lenses. He's one of the few directors still using split screens, and he definitely seems to appreciate the art of Steadicam, especially the long take. Your first time working with him was on 1987's The Untouchables, so let's examine the bookkeeper assassination sequence.
Okay, now, here we go. The car's in the alley. When you get him there, you don't answer the phone.
Yeah.
When we're coming, we're going to call. We're going to let it ring.
Twice.
We're going to call from?
From the corner.
Anybody knocks on the door?
Come out shooting. I got it.
You got it?
I got it.
Okay. Kind of enjoy the tactical aspects of law enforcement. Is that it,
Oscar? Oh, yeah. It's much more diverting than accounting.
Ready? I've been good to you. You got to be good to me.
Hey, we made a deal. We're going to stick to it, okay?
Oh, yeah. That was the first. Someone else had started that film, and I forget there was a scheduling conflict or something. Mm. And so they asked me to come in. Chicago, I think. So I flew in. Brian, I had no real read on him. Right away, though, when I got there for that long shot, he surprised me by walking through the shot. So he would follow people around. And if he got really close to somebody, that was obviously some sort of close up. And if he backed away, it was maybe a two or a three shot. No word said. And the actress would go through the choreography. It already worked. So I didn't have to do anything. So I followed him around very closely. And he went through pretty much the choreography the way the final shot was done. But I saw a few things that it would be better if. So I said, Brian, when we come back, is it okay? Why don't I do, yeah, sure. Okay. And then back here, you think we could have a cross or something? Because I need time to get back. Yeah, get across. And three or four of those, finally, it was like, whatever I said, he was just going to say, yeah, do it. Okay. Wow. And we nodded heads and he left. Yeah. So I had already, by that time, become very adamant about protecting the reputation of, not me, of Steadicam. Mm-hmm. I was one of the early guys. I wasn't doing features as early as like Ted Churchill, who was the big operator in New York City area as I started to work in there. But when I got to doing features, it was clear to me that this was still not totally accepted by the industry. And I knew from all those experiences of trying 36 times to do a shot mm-hmm. and only one worked, mm-hmm. that the Steadicam, as serious a liability as it was, a strength, depending on how it went. And I'd also already figured out what has become really important to me, that if you're doing an unedited single shot, which I've done many now, that you've got to edit in camera. Mm-hmm. And what that means is, if you need a wide shot and then you want to be close to someone, how do you do that mm-hmm. without it just being shoe leather? That was the big enemy in my brain. Shoe leather, shoe right. leather. Don't want any shoe leather. I didn't care whose toes I maybe was stepping on. Is this in service to the shot? Mm-hmm. I would take over mm-hmm. as needed to be sure, because ADs, especially then, weren't used to how this could happen. It was like you do a wide shot, you do a close up, you do a reverse, and they're masters at figuring out how to match. And well, now we're not doing that. So I would take over the choreography. And if I got bored, that would be death. Mm-hmm. So I never wanted to be bored. So throughout a shot, like including that one, I would work on choreographing everybody and all extras, especially extras. The actors had pretty well A to B. They had something to do. But if I needed a bit of distraction, I might ask an extra to do something or cause the actress to move out of their normal line of path because I wanted to get a little side version mm-hmm. or I didn't want it to be the same all the time. So that's what I did in that shot. And actors all really, I've never had a problem with asking them to do what you might think is outrageous for an operator to ask, changing their performance in many ways. So it worked for camera and not for me, but for the sake of the story mm-hmm. too. So that's always been extremely important to me. I would never do anything to show off, except once in a while, but only when that was called for. I likened it to being a great limousine driver. And my audience is in the back seat. I don't want them to be startled unless I really do want them to get scared on purpose. But I want to suggest that we're about to go into a turn. And they get a little sense of that. And then we go. I don't want to shock them. And no arbitrary anything in the shot. The frame, to me, should never do anything to distract from the idea that I'm trying to get across, which is performance, or it's a visual tableau, or whatever it is. Worked very hard on my own skills to be able to have a moving platform that didn't betray itself. It's the audience watching. So I would build into shots. If I wanted you to notice something over here, then I would get some way to bring the audience's eyes there, and then they see it. Ah, and then they leave frame and we look at this. So there's always some anchor point in my frame that becomes the center of attention, and maybe rotate around it and go off and find somebody else. But it's all about leading the audience down as if they were telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. So I want little interest in a frame, and then resolve that interest by showing it to the audience. So they are directing me. That's my goal.
Right. In this shot specifically, it's a three-person walk with Andy Garcia, Charles Martin Smith, and Brad Sullivan, who plays Capone's bookkeeper. In the sequence, you have Garcia positioning himself so that you can change the framing from a three-person to a two-person framing based on who is most essential to the story.
Right.
And we're going to talk about this throughout the podcast, but you're great at taking extras and choreographing them to motivate your camera movements. For example, in this shot, you have the woman who obviously got Capone's hitman into the building walk you down the hallway, which then allows Kevin Costner and Sean Connery to enter the sequence. So you were already taking that amount of control of a shot working with De Palma your first time?
With De Palma, yes. He would be no exception as far as I was concerned. Just how would he take this sort of thing? Well, he already told me. As soon as I suggested something, yeah. So like, okay.
To have that amount of faith in you, oh, wow.
Ryan looks like he's not paying attention a lot of the time. He sees everything. And he has a plan how a shot or scene will go. And he's worked all the odds. And he is devoted to doing like single take things. I guess just from Steve, boom, yeah, he'll do it. Yeah, it's good. That's all I can imagine. And that's why. But yeah, he left me to do it. And you're exactly right, especially anamorphic. Usually you think of it in thirds. If you're going to put somebody in the frame, it should be on one or the other side and two-thirds to something else. There should be a reason for having two-thirds of the frame. Makes sense. But in a situation like this, yes, exactly. I worked really hard with the actors on figuring out ways to motivate. When it was two of them talking together and you wanted to see, especially the rabid interest in the accountants, this is exciting. Right. And Andy Garcia, yeah, it's really great. Just the two of them. And then back out and it's the three of them. Actors have always been really appreciative of my efforts, and I think any operator, we're right there in their face. And how the camera responds is like how the audience is reacting, especially if it can be pure movements, very purposeful, no arbitrary anything. It isn't just the audience that senses that. It's the actress too, with the map box and my presence, paying attention, backing off, going a little to the side, moving in. It becomes a choreography between us. And we don't talk about it necessarily, but there's no question there's a feedback loop that gets stronger and stronger and becomes more and more trusting. That's always been good for me. The thrill of this whole thing, when I got done with it, I've learned with Steadicam, I mentioned, it's more like a unicycle. If you've got total control, it looks effortless and great. But one slip and you fall. Mm. And I mean, it's disaster.
Yeah.
Or it's like walking a tightrope. I've got to pay attention to every part of my balance and my body and control and all little techniques. And then if I find there's something that I'm weak on, is it me? Is it the equipment? What about the equipment? So yes, early on began modifying everything I touched to eliminate the unpleasantness of a certain shot. And then I'd go back into my shop, which has become bigger and bigger and bigger, to like fix it. In this case, doing all of that and taking over directing it, I was like a little concerned how Brian would react to it. When we started shooting it, it was just like, okay, let's do another one. Okay. No direction for me.
Wow.
Or even generally for the actors. He attended, especially that part of his career, really dependent on the actors to figure out what's not working between them. For me, I would figure out what wasn't working as a result. And almost always on a long shot, it would be take seven. Maybe take eight, maybe earlier, take seven before we all collectively suddenly were in the same group. And if that didn't work and we want to do another one, okay, but it would be two or three takes. It would fall apart. 10, 11, 12, 12, 12. Oh, yeah, okay. Almost always take seven. Lucky seven. I don't know. In any case, I don't know how many takes we did, probably seven. And the next day, after Brian had seen dailies, I was crossing with some of my fellow colleagues. And he was walking by, paying us no attention, suddenly stopped. Larry, what? That was good. Thanks, Brian. Walked by. And the rest of the crew members were like, he never talks to anybody. Oh, my God. So, I mean, he had found in me, like actors he likes, I view it very similarly, someone who understood his sensibilities, his aesthetics. Which certainly I knew some of watching his films, but more it was the way he choreographed the action that just allowed me to like, well, I'll just fix a few things here.
He obviously had a lot of trust in you. He went on to do seven more movies with you.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'll go ahead and tell you what you did throughout your amazing career.
Thank you.
Let's move on to 1992's Raising Kane.
So what was the book called?
Raising Cain, The Creation and Evolution of the Multiple Personality. It was a bestseller. They even made a TV movie out of it. I heard he made quite a lot of money.
You have a 4-minute uninterrupted oner that has Greg Henry leading a psychiatrist down multiple floors of a building into a highly reflective elevator. And then it has some of your signature Dutch angles. Can you talk about that?
See, they were my signature. They were Steve Burrows.
Oh, really? Okay. Because I've seen them pop up in other movies. And now that I'm thinking about them,
they
might be De Palma films, so who knows?
When you learn something from somebody, you can then take it. This is a low budget movie. Was that after Casualties of War? I think he was kind of licking his wounds, De Palma, after something. And so this was a chance to make a film he was interested in, but very low budget, but with great crew. But we could not afford amazing, huge lighting budgets that Steve is very good at using. That whole scene took place primarily in this open area. I can't remember exactly, but there was light coming through.
Yeah, almost like a sunroof.
Yeah, and it was like a periphery of several levels that both Brian and Steve wanted to make use of. So they worked out more or less how the path of the actress would be and where the camera should be. So that was a great learning experience for me as well, because I set it up and very careful about level. You know, we're real worried about horizon, but if you have anamorphic and you're tilting up and you're panning over, because the idea was starting above us, walking across left to right, and partly it was me too. I hate Steadicam just following its exact same distance. What the fuck? I mean, that's one idea, but I get bored. So I want to open it up and I want to figure out ways for that to happen. And one of the issues I have a lot of times with fast moving Steadicam, if there's something moving fast and you're moving fast with them, it's not moving anymore. Mm-hmm. I want them to go by me. I want to catch up to them. I want that flexibility. I want it like a rubber band. So I think I probably wanted them to come across my frame, even though it was moving, and both of us going towards a goal. They're going faster than me, but the goal is the stairs that they come back down. So I started off just perfect horizon level. But if you're doing perfect horizon with a wide shot and you're looking up and there's something that is definitely horizontal in the frame, like the balcony, it goes at a real steep angle through the frame,
right?
Which is really obvious with anamorphic. So Steve said, Larry, what? Touch it. What? Look at your frame. Line up the bottom of the frame with the rails there. Come on. You know, he was my coach. He was a mentor. He was a teacher. He taught me a great deal about composition, particularly for anamorphic. But Steve, that's going to be really hard to do, because it's unnatural to hold pressure all the way through a shot, but you have to relieve it until finally when they're right across from me. Now it's level for a second, and then I have to touch the other way to keep those rails. Then they're coming down the stairs, and at some point I knew we'd have to go back to normal level. I tried to figure out a way to do it. As they're coming down the stairs, I took the Dutch out until as they hit the bottom, we're level again. So that sort of set a theme. And the first part, I don't think audience would notice. That's how to not be noticeable, is by doing all of that. Mm-hmm. Once they got down and we're going around, again, I didn't like just to have the three of them walking and talking together. Like, okay, I'm bored. As soon as I get bored, something has to happen. So there were corners. They probably could have just made a short cut, but we had to have enough distance, shoe leather, for them to do the dialogue. So as they started to come around, I tried at each corner to have it look different in some way, but maintaining more or less the same comfortable distance that an audience would want. But the last corner was leading to the stairs, and there were two stairs parallel to each other. I had to go down one while they went down the other. I had to be much wider to be able to see that. I didn't want to just suck back. Why did the camera suck back? There wasn't any reason, except for the stairs. So then I started working with the actors. Again, Brian's not there. I'm taking over for the benefit of all. So I asked her, it looks like you're really in your own thought and you don't know where you're going. You're leading them. Why not you just go straight? And they have to rush, catch you back up, pull you back the direction. In that time, I would widen the frame to keep them all in frame. And then they would come to me and down we go. So when we anamorphic frame, and the stairs are at a 30-degree angle or something, they didn't all fit. Because I chop off somebody's head or somebody's feet. Steve is like, Larry, that's it. Steve, that's going to be almost impossible. I mean, especially because they hit a landing. How do I frame that part without, but okay. So we radical thing, and it looked like they were walking down backwards, you know, leaning back as a result of my angle, which is a little awkward and weird. But the whole scene is getting weird. And the actors, once I started messing with them a little bit, I wanted at times, like if she's in front and they're behind, why don't you kind of make fun of her? Because that was part of the story.
Right.
They thought she was a dingbat, kind of. So they started picking that on.
She kept getting lost in the building. And you pan yeah. with her too when she gets lost twice in this whole long sequence.
That became a theme and they went with it. Turned out to be a lot easier to take out that Dutch at the bottom. It just was a natural thing. Whoever's in front leads the frame and allows me to take the Dutch out. And then now we're back to normal, except I wanted a moment to get around in front of them. So I wanted some excuse to have the camera hurry a bit and get around. So then I said, why don't you guys just let her go ahead? And then you realize she's going the wrong way, run and catch up with her. Oh, and that was the point where I said, you could make fun of her. You could, so that we have something to watch. And then we rush together to find her, turn around as a catcher and make sure that the choreography works. And then we back towards the elevator. And the elevator was only one floor down, but the dialogue that we wanted in there was like two or three floors down. I wanted desperately to try to keep the audience from knowing that the elevator stopped. And it's very hard with a Steadicam if it wants to keep moving. The elevator stops, it wants to bottom down, you know, move. So I asked one of the actors to, at that moment, lean against the wall a little bit to take away any notice of my movement with his movement. And then, yes, somebody shorter, somebody's taller, we're close to the elevator.
Yeah, you did another Dutch in there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a theme now, so let's just keep using it. And then when we finally got to the bottom, I gave a little, like, oh, we stopped. Doors open, we go out. In any case, we did. Again, it was probably take 7 or 8. The light, though, when it goes down, we are done. Mm. There's no lighting available in the puzzle. It's got to happen. And the light is starting to go down. Steve is like, Larry, we got to get this. And we had one perfect take. At the very end, though, as we find the cadaver, and she's moving to one side, the actress are joining, and I'm going around to go across the cadaver to them. My monitor touched the toe of the cadaver. Boom! Seconds from the end, Brian was like, let's do it again. That was
oh,
it.
Oh, man.
Okay. When you have a challenge where you have to have no cuts, everybody's got to perform throughout. We all relish that challenge and rise to it. So I was like, oh, fuck, David. But the next take was great, and that's probably what in the film. But as we were watching in between each take, a playback, a shot this long, you really need the playback to watch, especially me as an operator. I'm doing all this logistics and rushing and back and forth. What does it really look like for a static audience in a seat looking at a big screen? There's a lot of stuff I might not notice. And if there's a little movement here or there, that's totally distracted, disruptive. But even more important, are we really seeing what we want to see? When we want to see it, it was the rhythm right, the timing right for the comedy, for the drama. So we will watch each one. And as soon as we got to the stair where there's a big Dutch, Brian would go.
Tilt his head sideways.
Yeah, Steve and I are looking at each other. And the first time, I think Brian turned around and looked at Steve, and Steve said, and he looked at me, and I said, every take, no discussion.
Never questioned it.
Well, he was questioning it, I think, accepting it. You guys want to do this? You want to hang yourselves? That's fine. Right. I don't know what he was thinking. I don't think I saw any audience members doing that. But yeah, so a lot of trust, obviously, a lot of trust in the team.
Let's move on to 1993's Carlito's Way.
Pachanga.
Carlito, man, where the hell you been? Mira, you know somebody tried to kill my buddy.
Yeah, I heard about it. Listen. Me and Gail are going out of town for a couple of days.
Ah, you're going to get married. Listen
to me, man. I want you to go to Gail's house, pick her up, drive her to Grand Central.
Okay,
right?
Okay, you got
it. I want you to wait with her there for me. Wait till I get there. Train leaves 11:30 sharp. We can't miss this train. You understand?
Yeah.
You got me?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead now.
De Palma has said about Carlito's Way, I can't make a better picture than this. There's so much I want to ask you about this film, but for the sake of time, let's concentrate on the last half hour. Beginning with the hospital sequences, and then you're back in the nightclub where Pacino is grabbing his money and hauling ass throughout that entire sequence. And then definitely I want to touch base on the Grand Central train station conclusion. It looked like you were running nonstop for that whole last half hour.
Yeah, I don't run with Steadicam. I pretty much always avoid that if I can. At first, just because I can't maintain effective control of the frame. Handheld work for me is the worst curse you can make. On a big screen, especially. So I want it fucking stable. There's no point in bringing attention to myself if you can't do it with the drama and the action and the actors, then you're full of shit. And you're just trying to disguise that you haven't got a good idea. That's my view of most handheld work, of which I've still participated quite often when necessary. So running, no. I think back then, just used a small doorway dolly and running forward. Then we took the steering bar and shortened it. And one of our wonderful grips got down really low so I could shoot over him. Every time I come up with a problem on a film, then I go back in the shop and try to figure it out. So I had already built a very stable way of shooting from vehicles. And it consisted of a bazooka system, which is a French system. Gas shock would go up and down. There were a couple of different bazookas, so you could have a height from there to there or there to there. So it's a European-based system. And I built a seat, which I found in a boat show. So it was a fishing seat, which was very narrow. I actually turned it 90 degrees. So I was sitting on the back and the what you're supposed to straddle, whatever. I built an adapter for it to go to a Mitchell. And a Mitchell would go on three-way level head on the bazooka. And then there were several bases that I either used or built that they could harden out to something, anything.
Okay.
I've used it throughout my career on cranes, on dollies, on ATVs, whatever. But it was a way for me either be really locked in if I didn't have to get off, or a seat that I could push myself back into and then step off as well.
Gotcha.
So I didn't have a cart then that would do this. We used what they had. And they were really good. Grips pushing, hauling ass, guy underneath the lens, steering. I think for the first stuff out in the street when he flees the bar, it was a big, big dolly for hauling gear, but also for camera work. Nice, big, huge tires, really stable. So that's how I did the running shots after him. But stepping off, I guess, people throw stairs in for me out of apple boxes so I could then do little moves up, things like that. Since then, I have a couple of quick aluminum steps that can get unfolded, thrown in front of me, wow. And I can step up and I can step off of them and I whip it off. But every time I hit an obstacle, we solve it one way or another, but it's a little crude, then I go back and figure out a way to have it always ready, which means that I've got a big amount of equipment in my trailer. But in any case, that was like not me running,
gotcha.
Generally. Although when they first take off of the subway, I did do a half trot because it made sense.
Let me ask you a quick question. The sequences inside of some of the train carts, how did you do that?
My balance.
Oh, man.
Brian wants the real deal, especially get a shot from one moving subway car to another one. So he had special arrangements with the subway system and to be able to get to that. And he really wanted that. But in between, we were just all in a train. He did the choreography, and I would just finesse it and work with Al, you know, who is unbelievably, it's not cooperative. It's not, he's just, he totally gets how I'm moving the camera and how he's responding to it, or how he's moving and how I'm responding to it. But it is a dance, no question.
Oh, for sure. There's scenes in there, especially where he's like ducking, covering behind like walls.
Yeah.
You're wrapping around and hitting these hard stops right when he stops to like hide from
yes.
the gangsters. Oh, man, it is gorgeous stuff, man. And it just adds so much to that scene.
And some of those are actual audible cues that they had to get rid of, where I would tell him when to do something. So we're both in sync at the same time. We're also, especially one of my favorite moments, there's always the difference between the people, in this case, actors, can see each other, and when the camera can see that they can see each other. The actor cannot always understand the timing required from the camera's perspective. So then I would cue him when it's time. Brian loves to do that too. So sometimes he was cueing the two of us, like when he's crouching, hiding from the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Behind the scenes footage that I've got from somewhere, you can hear him. And he goes, rise. And the two of us stand up together. So he would be cueing some things, I'd be cueing others. So what I loved was he's starting to go down an escalator and the other guys are coming up. And he wanted me to tell him when to, oh shit, and run back up. And so I purposely let it go a little deeper than he was expecting, or realistically, possibly the gangsters could figure out, ow, and he, oh shit, and he had to scramble up more stairs than he was expecting. But that created this great back and forth tussle. And then, yes, we worked on and rehearsed One of the things I do in long shots is I don't just do it. We do a pass after I've worked out everything anyway, without even the actual stand-ins. And if you have great stand-ins for great actors and they often go together, So I will go through every part of it with a viewfinder first. No steady cam, that's like heavy. And work out exactly where the camera should be at exactly what time and who would be in the frame and who would not and what they should do as a result, and rehearse with every single person who's in that frame, every person, especially the extras. Okay, when I'm here, you're doing that? No, because I notice you noticing me. So we got to figure out another way. So I work with them, and every bit of every part is rehearsed in segments. And I want no misunderstanding. Like, normally, if you're cutting, you try something, it didn't work, and the AD is run over and say, don't look at him. Wait a second. You can't do that. You'd never make it. So I take it as my personal responsibility. Every single actor and every single take to go back through and like, you were a little early, remember? Oh yeah. Okay. And Al, the next time, if you go just a touch deeper, I will rehearse those segments finally with the Steadicam before trying to put it all together. Because in my head, I know how it's all going to go together now. I planned it with a finder based on De Palma's masterful choreography to begin with. I'm just on top finessing. And then when everything is absolutely worked out, then try it all as one. So now my job, and it's the way I teach Steadicam courses, my input rather than just the basics of control and everything, is a given shot, even if it's documentary, should in your mind already become camera lens is here and it moves to there. And then it goes here because each moment is like a frame. That's massively important, especially anamorphic, especially Grand Central.
Yeah.
There's only one right place for the camera to be. So your job is just to move the lens from A to B to C to D. Now I know where I'm going. And I also know what everybody else is supposed to be doing in the frame. It's so well rehearsed that I can now liberate myself from those mechanical aspects. And I can now really respond in a much more fine way to what the actors are showing me. And they start to dig down, get comfortable. Now they'll do stuff that like makes me respond as the audience. Oh shit. Wait a minute. What is he doing? Oh, he's doing something else. So it's only paying attention to the details and becoming obsessive about all the mechanics. I'm not going to run. I'm going to ride. I'm getting too close, too far, too fast. That you can then make it effortless looking. But it ain't effortless. It's like really focused on every detail.
De Palma once said this about the long take. You can document the emotion in real time. I think that holds especially true for Carlito's Way when you can see Pacino's descent into desperation. He's out of breath. He's got points of stress coming at him from all angles. And he just wants to get to his girlfriend at the train station.
He's going
to
make it, right? He's done it.
Yeah, you think. I'll just leave it at that in case anyone hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah.
I just wanted to touch base on one more thing that I'll bring up in the Kill Bill discussion, but there's a sequence when you're on a boat dock. You switch from a leading shot to a follow with Sean Penn and Pacino, and as you ascend the dock stairs, you're so good at this, but you just nail headroom. There's a third actor they're meeting up with, Adrian Pasdar. You kill it every single time.
Got to.
I'm sure you're loving all these compliments, but oh man, I got to tell you, I'm watching that scene and I'm like, it's right on the top of his head. It's right on the line. He's got the headroom so perfectly framed.
And it's stairs?
Yeah.
On stairs. Holy shit. So if I go down the stairs and they're not, I've got to be booming up.
I'm going to bring this up later, but you destroy headroom.
One little extra bit about that Grand Central. Some of the framing I had to do was because Steve had massive lighting in that. So now you could do available light, not then. So there are huge bounces up high and in the glass reflecting, and we couldn't take them out in post. That didn't exist. Some of the choreography with Al was go out a little wide here, turn around and look now. And it was in order to frame off a reflection of glass and then come back when it was safe. So all those little details that got to be there. Otherwise, it looks mechanical. It looks forced. So there's got to be a motivation for me to move that frame.
I see it. There's a shot in the train car. I'm looking for your reflection. I'm looking. You positioned yourself and there's no reflection of you in the camera. And I'm like, this guy is nailing it within centimeters every single time. I love it.
Got to. Especially back then with film, how was it for focus? I mean, eventually I nailed that problem too by inheriting essentially Ted Churchill's camera, movie cam, which he had sort of helped design to be a first camera that was really light enough, quiet enough, and well balanced enough. The film running through didn't change the CG, that it was a great Steadicam camera. And his brother just said, look, Ted would want you to have this. So I inherited it, basically.
Like inheriting Excalibur there.
Yes, but it wasn't good enough for me because you still couldn't see fucking focus. What I did was finally work with Ed DiGiulio, Cinema Products. He had been asked to engineer pedestal cameras, film cameras, that they could do like soap operas kind of style, but be able to do focus too. So you needed to have something that you could focus on a film camera. So he came up with this system, which was a, I'm getting nerdy, he said, a fiber optic bundle. So the fiber optic bundle would start in place of what we'd normally have a ground glass. And instead of a fiber optic bundle, then it was pulled very delicately and perfectly to the size and shape of a fairly small sensor that was extreme high resolution. And he had made a color version, a black and white version. Black and white was almost no latency at all. So black and white tap that I had to modify my movie cam to fit. And it had to permanently become a video only. There was no place for an eyepiece, no way to see it other than the video tap. So it was the first film camera that you could videotape and play back and you know absolutely for sure if it's focused or not. But before then, and it's a good thing I didn't have that as a crutch. Yeah. All Steadicam operators now starting with Alexas and Reds and they can see. Yeah. Well, there was a discipline required to be able to work with my assistant who for years was Larry Houston with anamorphic and you're pretty close. And especially a place like Grand Central, if people were close, the depth of field was like, what? So I had hit marks. I began, especially for focus, to be absolutely precise, making marks, hitting them. I had lasers that would shoot straight down from the sled. And when I hit the little piece of tape, I could, a little flare I could notice without looking. I'm on the mark. I'm on the mark.
Really?
If I had the correct tilt in for that part of the shot, I realized that my responsibility for the whole film to have it be in focus was I had to fit marks. And I also let the actors know, you've got to hit that mark. Now, if it's just moving throughout, okay, we don't have that luxury. But whenever possible, I made the shot design not look limited by the need for precision, but simply be more powerful because of the precision and it would be in focus. So I developed that real precise distance for Larry to be able to get sharp. Otherwise, everybody's job was fucked. So there was a discipline involved for that reason, but I extended it to all aspects, as you said.
Yeah, and for reflections and stuff.
Very important headroom looks. I mean, with anamorphic frame, you got to.
You're amazing at it. We'll bring it up later,
Steve,
I promise.
Let me know when I wasn't doing it.
Let's move on to 1998's Snake Eyes. It's the shot everyone talks about when they mention this movie, the jaw-dropping 12-minute sequence that tracks Nicolas Cage around a sold-out crowd at a boxing match.
Tyler! Woo! Neptune High, right? Check it out right here! Go Sea Devils! You and me, Tyler! Yeah! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Go, Tyler! Wow! Lincoln, Tyler! Lincoln, Tyler! Lincoln! Ow! My lucky number 7.
Again, this is one of your more famous shots. I know you and I touched base before this, and you let me know that this was actually broken up into a couple of different shots. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of people think that it is one take. So I don't know if you want to tell the story, but...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I am. That's fucking heavy thing of a... That's like more than a 1,000-foot load. That's like, no way. So, okay, we're doing Steadicam. Okay. And Brian had pretty well worked out all the choreography and all the major strokes, what he wanted. He's the master choreographer of camera movement to tell the story. And we go all the way through it. And I'm, of course, timing. And we get to the end. I said, can't do it. Not in one take. Are you sure? I'm positive. Well, what do we do? I said, we're going to have to break it up. But we can't. I think we can do it with a little sleight of hand. In fact, I think it might even help some of that part. Okay, what? Let's go through it again. We get to a certain point when time says I'm running out of film, and Nick Cage goes around the corner, and it's a four-sided pillar that separates the floor from the stairs that go 180 degrees the other way. One of the things about film versus our own understanding of the world is film, if it's 2D, is flat. And if you pan all the way around 360, the audience thinks they've gone maybe 200 degrees, 250, and you're back to, wait a minute, I'm already back. It's not a one-to-one relationship. So there's some room to fudge. And in fact, it's kind of boring to go all the way around the pillar. I mean, I would hang on the pillar, okay, and there would be Nick, but it's a lot of wasted time, a lot of shoe leather. So I said, let's just get to that pillar and I'll just wipe through it. And then we'll pick up 90 degrees after that. I'll wipe through the 90 degree later face of the pillar and reveal him on the other side going down the stairs. So it was actually much more efficient filmmaking. You know, we couldn't do optical effects much. I said, and it's going to feel more real if we just do the simplest, crudest kind of techniques. So the very beginning suggested we do it a dolly shot. It made more sense going past some monitors and shit. I said, I need a big guy, security guy, big guy. No, really big guy. So we had a big guy walk through, and then I would pick it up steady cam. Big guy walks through, probably the other way. And then follow up the stairs. A lot of choreography with Nick's stand-in, who was un-fucking believable. The relationship they had with each other. I did so many very specific bits of choreography with his stand-in, which he communicated to Nick without my having to really go over, except for a few details that I wanted to make sure he knew personally. But he got it. Because going upstairs, it could look stupid. It's really hard for it not to be stupid. We would do 1 4-minute chunk, roughly, and that would be the day. And then we rehearse what we're going to do the next 4 minutes. Well, however far. Can't we go further, Larry? No. Nope. So then how are we going to do? Okay. So I'd engineer another cross. And by just being very careful to mark where a cross was and where I was, and the lighting, Steve, of course, made the same, it was invisible.
It's a seamless shot.
Yeah. I still sometimes wake up thinking about, there's one moment when in all the shots that I've done, I'm following somebody, I want to see their face at a point where it makes sense. I don't want to cut around. But no. So I have them come around. So at one point, and he's talking on the phone to his girlfriend, lying, no, honey, I am at the fight. Something like that. Man, I really want to see that, what you're doing. So he engineered this, like holding the phone up so she could hear the crowd cheering and spinning around for me to do that. And I had to tilt up to get the phone just right and come back down. But he's very precise too. So we could precisely do those things. Headroom, it's all about actors too. They can't do something unexpected. They do. I'm just going to let it go, come back up. So they understand the precision needed to do it if they're great actors. Now, near the end, there was some stuff that to me shouldn't be Steadicam. It needed to be much longer lenses. I'm not going to do that. We'd have the dolly and A operator come in. Doug, he would come in. Again, we'd do a white Steadicam to suddenly long lens, like almost always a 40 with Steve Burham, but go to a long lens, 180 millimeters or something. And I cut back, and then it's back to me again. And I see those really almost offensively, but in the spirit of the shot, it worked. Even those worked.
Thanks for the breakdown on that very famous shot. Yeah. Hey, I got a quick follow-up question. Do you think in the digital world, you could do that all in one take now?
No.
Okay. Appreciate your honesty.
No, that would be stupid. Let's say all the little details that have to work, pushing past that 4 or 5 minute, for one, my body was tuned to it. But my brain, too, it would fall apart. There would be mistakes in it.
Gotcha.
Yeah, maybe it could be done, but it would defeat the purpose of doing it in one. It would fracture. The shot would not be seamless. It would have mistakes in it. So, I mean, there might be some reason. And it did come up. And I almost was doing it on Kill Bill. But ultimately, I didn't have to. I mean, I suppose I could. And maybe I could build up the mental reserves to handle all the details. I'd say normally it's statistically impossible to have a perfect shot that lasts 4 or 5 minutes. I have achieved it with incredible cast and crew several times because everybody goes way out of their way. And the biggest thrill for doing that isn't just the actors who feel and understand the relationship between them and the timing. Everything is like on stage, theater, and the audience is responding. Well, I'm the audience and I'm responding. There's something very different that happens instead of just taking it apart and cutting into pieces. And you know, every cut that you make is very disruptive. And you can use that on purpose to disrupt the audience, to get them off guard. If you talk to an editor who really understands what they're doing, because a lot of us, even Steadicam operators, will do something just because, why are you doing that? Teaching is what makes you understand what you're doing and why, and re-examine. Maybe I should do something else. You become conscious of those little details. A good editor will, in a conversation, especially like in a car where you're shooting back and forth and the driver's going that way and the passenger's going that way, and every time you cut, they're going the opposite direction at a high rate of speed, totally fucks your brain. So the dialogue, if you were to listen to it without watching, you'll see somebody says, so where were you? Oh, I was back in the store. No, you weren't. Big pauses, because the editors have consciously or unconsciously thrown in pad for the audience. Wait a minute, we're in the same car going the other way? No, that's not right. Oh, right. And then they can listen again. If you just cut it, you would miss a word or two. So all of those distortions to things go away with a single shot. It's such a more pure way of doing it. But you've got to then use other tools to allow to have actors spin around, create a reason for them to spin around, make it better for the story that they spun around and followed. One last bit, Ryan, all seeing, all knowing. There was a point in that shot getting near the end. I think I go up to the ring just a moment, like, ding, ding, or something, and I got back down. And Brian, we would love to be right by the camera all the time. Great directors love to be there. So this is one of the places that he could be next to me. But I kept coming down, and he was a little bit in my way. And I'd have to do a little move around it. Oh, God. Hey, Brian, I just need a little more room there. Okay. Oh, he's there again. Oh, Brian, if you just make sure, don't cross that. I'll be able to get right in there with the camera. Yeah, just no problem. I'll do it. He's there again. So finally, I step on his foot in the shot, and he jumps out of the way, and I have the perfect friend. God, how was it, Larry? It was great. And he comes to me and said, don't you ever do that again. Okay. Oh, no foul. I was like, uh-oh, I'm done. All right.
Hey, let's move on to the last movie I want to touch base on for De Palma, 2002's Femme Fatale. You changed the director of photography to Terry Arbogast, who I believe is Luc Besson's director of photography. After having a challenging time working on Mission to Mars, De Palma decides he doesn't want to work in America, and you join him in France for the Cannes segments. I know you kind of touched base with a little funny story about your equipment and what happened. Do you mind telling that story real fast before we move on?
So, Brian was, again, one of those places where he wanted to make a movie, but nobody would fund it properly, so went to Europe. Much cheaper overall, especially the way the film was designed. He's a master at doing more for less. I came in only for the one sequence in Cannes at the film festival. So we arrived just as the film festival was closing out, and production had made deal for them just leave a lot of the dressing in place.
Oh, wow.
And then all the real people go away, but we still had the red carpet, you know, a lot of signs. We had to change a lot of things, but still. So things are different over there, I discovered. So I had Larry Houston with me, and I didn't have my magic movie cam yet. It was my camera, but you couldn't see focus for sure. We put the lens up. It's Panavision. So we're trusting a Panavision. I mean, Panavision, Panavision worldwide. That's one of the great attributes. Panavision controls everything everywhere. Great. Put the lens up, and it's not coming up. Marks are not hitting where they should when he's looking by eye. Put up another lens. Same thing, a little different. All the lenses aren't coming up. And Larry, like me, had a lot of tools. So he had a borescope, or I think it was, he could go in and he could just make sure that the depth on my camera was accurate. It was right on. It was my responsibility to put in frame lines electronically because there was no ground glass. So I had to develop this whole system of charts and a portable optical bench that I could bring around, and I could be absolutely sure that the frame lines were right, that the focus was right, all that. we were pretty confident then the camera. So what's wrong with these lenses? And he walked over to talk to the assistants, and Panavision for some reason then did not set the depth on their cameras. So what they did was they had A camera, B camera, A camera lens. They put the lenses up, and just by eye, they would focus it, and then they would put tape over the focus marks to mark 2 feet, 3 feet, 6 feet, remark every lens to match the fact that their camera was not on the correct depth. And they have a separate set of lenses for the B camera because it was also not set to correct depth, but differently. So then we're like, oh my God, like, am I running out of time here? We're doing this in the day, and the night shoot is when I'm going to start filming. So we figured that out finally. So Larry stripped off those marks, put them carefully aside for them to put back on later, and checked it, and everything was coming up pretty good. And I think maybe he fudged a couple. So, oh, thank God. So everything's working. Camera's working. Steadicam's working. Everything's great. Lunch, which would be just before it got dark and we start to film for the night. And my Steadicam was on a stand. It was right by the camera truck. And they were loading some things in for safety. And the tailgate goes up and it catches the stand and flips it over. And I remember it slow motion, reaching out to grab it before it. And I didn't get there. And I watched the Steadicam go down and smash on the ground. And I saw it fall into two pieces. And I saw ball bearings and things running into the gutter. I was trying to catch it before they went all the way. And I was like, I'm not going to be taking lunch. And I'm used to crews where the entire camera crew would come around me and help me solve this problem. They're like, no, we're okay. We'll see you later. I said, well, is there anybody who's got tools that I can use? I made a grip. Nobody had anything on that production, at least, to help me. Okay, I got my tool cases. Opened all the tool cases. And I start sawing things apart. I finally figured that it was a stage that gives me very precise balance. Side to side, front to back. Forget that. That's what broke and fell apart into pieces.
Wow.
And I had to drill and tap holes and bolt the stage all together, fixed, locked, hoping it's going to be about the right balance. Put the camera on and it's almost right by cheating the monitor a little and fucking with things a little bit. It may not be perfectly dynamically balanced. Well, I was used to that in the old days, so I could fight that and I could learn that. Okay, I did it. Everybody comes back for lunch, and Brian is like, okay. And I'm like, but got through it.
Let's transition into Martin Scorsese and his director of photography, Michael Balhaas. Obviously, we're going to talk about Goodfellas in 2 seconds, but I did want to touch base on 1985's After Hours. You could definitely tell Scorsese was starting to get more aggressive with his camera work at that point in his career. Since you two had never worked together before, how were you able to meet in the middle as far as creation and execution of your shots for this production?
No, that didn't happen. They had shot the whole film. I had nothing to do with it. And then there was editing. And built into the schedule was after, I don't know what it was, a month or two, everybody comes back to shoot the scenes that got to be reshot. Built into the schedule. Let's fix the things that come up during editing. And in addition, an ending sequence.
That amazing sequence over the end credits. Unbelievable shot.
Cool. Right now, I don't know if I would agree with that, but then... always after the best shot I've ever done, I was like, oh man, why did I? But it's my first big movie. I mean, it's Scorsese, Michael Balhaas. And I'm feeling a little bit intimidated by the whole thing and wondering, how do I fit in? What should I say? How should I act? What should I do? I mean, I'm used to taking things over and fixing and making sure it works, but this is different. This is a different league. But Marty and Michael and the first AD, second AD, it was a small crew, were so relaxed. They had it. They'd done it. It was in the can. This is just fluff. This is just fun. And he had even brought his parents in, Marty had, to watch the film. A lot of times he couldn't bring them in for some of the violent things. You know, every once in a while there'd be an opportunity. This was one. This is icing on the cake. I had a video transmitter system. In the beginning, I had to build them myself. So I remember which one we had, but it worked through walls. They all went to another room next to the big workspace room. Transmit through. Yeah, that's all working. Good, good. And he had audio system speakers for me. And he had the music already picked out. He knew. And Michael said, you know, Larry, you can shoot anything, anywhere. He had papered all the office doors and just light them. They glowed. So I said, you do whatever you want, anything. And they had one scripted bit that I worked out very carefully, much on the floor. Everything's just right. And he hits the button, boom, and then cut to the shot that was for credits. And he said, so just have fun. I'll play you music. Okay. And they left. He's in another room. And I'm like, what the fuck? Okay. So I'm back making student film. I'm like, it's just me.
You're excited to work with Martin Scorsese and he leaves the room. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So with the first AD, I said, well, we have a few people if you want, Larry. Okay. What should I do? Okay. So I start to work out like at least a path that mm-hmm. I can follow. Try to be pushing, try to be pulling, try to mix it up the way I usually do. Spin around things, white by stuff. So we do some minor choreography. Can we get one more guy to do a wipe at the end? Yeah, okay. And we have somebody who's looking back. Could you move just to your left? When I come by, make sure. And so I talk to each of those. But then, what? Action. Music's playing and I'm just lying around with the camera, just having a ball. And you can hear. And after a couple of takes, I'm like, this is unreal. This is not what I thought it would be. I thought tension, really difficult. And I remember one time I thought, let me give him a throw because I know they're watching what I'm doing live. So I just said again, before the take, I flipped it, did a 360 flip and grabbed it. Yay! They're all screaming and yelling, laughing, having a great time. So that was my first work with Scorsese.
I love it.
I think it set the pattern then. And I'm sure Ryan and Marty talk, VPs talk. There was probably already a sense of like, just let him go. From then on, it was always the same. He would show kind of what he wanted for the shot and then walk away and I'd work it out. And I think part of that is because I was one of the first to really make the Steadicam work.
Scorsese trusting you, which is going to transition into the next movie we have to talk about. We have to talk about this. Is 1990's Goodfellas.
See you later. Thanks.
What are you doing? You're leaving your car?
Watch, it's a car for me. It's easier than leaving it out of the garage and waiting. It's a lot quicker that way.
Your work is littered throughout this movie. There's some amazing shots in there, like the introduction of all the gangsters where everyone's giving their names and stuff.
One of those perfect shots I've ever done.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. But for time, I'm going to shorten it down to, unfortunately, your most famous shot, whether you want to admit it or not, but the Copacabana shot, which was originally designed to just be a point A to point B type sequence. I think I've heard some interviews where you talk about how he basically just kind of gave you carte blanche to design that shot.
Well, that's what he did. So... he led us through late afternoon. I think we came as a call, went through the scene. So I'm like, okay. And Marty would walk through following the action. There was one specific start, the close up on a tip, and then let them get away. So then we all walk. There's all the ADs and PAs and Michael Bauhaus, of course, and my assistant and me. And we're just, okay, we're walking. And then we're going downstairs. And then we're going on a corridor. And I'm like, there's no dialogue. I was just called on that film. With very little advance notice. Are you available? Yeah. Okay. We're passing by the kitchen and Michael, first time he said anything, no, Marty, no, we have to go into the kitchen. And Marty said, well, why do we go into the kitchen? The club's right there. Why would we? Because of the fluorescent lights. They're different. What? Yeah, they're more green. It's perfect. It's beautiful. We have to go through it. Come back. Okay. So we walk around through the kitchen and come back out the same door we just went in. And I'm like, what? Then we get into the club. Then there's highly choreographed action. And it's something that Marty was very involved in and very specific about. And they had pre-rehearsed like the magic trick of a table flying in and then getting set and a lamp put in and plugged in. It was like, wow, they choreographed the shit out of that. I didn't have anything to do with that. Just how am I going to shoot it? Marty turns to me and he leaves. So Ray sees my eyes going like, because I see my career going down in flames again. And I'm thinking, I don't want to be judgmental, but this will be the worst case of shoe leather in the history of cinema. This is going to be total shit. And Ray's looking at me thinking that. And he says, hey, Larry, you want me to stay, help work out the shot? Yes.
Wow.
Please. And Lorraine says, do I need to stay? And we both turned to her, no, because clearly she's just following. He's leading.
She's the passenger of that scene.
Yes, exactly. She'll go wherever he tells her to go, like a little puppy dog kind of, which is how she would describe it, I'm sure, until we get to the table scene. We start working it out. And again, can't cut. But if I get bored, it's wrong. So we got to do something. And this is typical of trying to do continuous shots. starts close on that bill, and then they get away from me. And they start going down the stairs, and at the end of the stairs, they're going to disappear around a corner. It's like I can't get close to them to go down the stairs, or I'm just looking at the tops of their head. It's not attractive. I need to keep it wide, at least as they start going down the stairs. And I also want to show the audience that they're going downstairs and where it is and what part of the architecture it is. I don't want it just to be abstracted. Where are they? And they go down. And I said, I need a little bit of a stall as you finish the stairs to turn the corner. So I can do something to get close enough to you and not lose you around the corner. You have to slow up. Our first AD, Giuridi, is like, well, we got a doorman. Should we use a doorman? Ray's like, absolutely. You know what? I'll tip him. Cool idea. Tip the beginning, tipping now. I like it. Okay, so we do that, and he does the tipping, and he's turning around and backing up. So I see him interacting without being in front of him. And then down the hall they go, and I'm walking and we're walking. I said, okay, I'm bored. Bored. We're going to do something. I need to see your face again, Ray. I need to see something. And Joe says, well, we got a lot of extras we can bring in. I think probably one or the other of them suggested like a couple making out. And Ray's like, yeah, no, I can make a comment. That would be great. Yeah, let's do that. Okay. So now we have somebody that we're coming to that we see coming ahead for the audience. It's like, what are they doing? And then Ray starts talking to him, turns around, backing away. I see his, it's like, fucking, yes, this is great. Then he's got to go into the kitchen. I was desperate not to let the audience know that we came back out the same door. And it was only many years later that I thought, what difference would it have made? He's just showing off the power of his entree. He could go anywhere. But I was desperate for that. So to the AD, we got to have a flurry of activity going in and a flurry coming out. Well, why? I don't want anybody to know what happened. And again, that same notion, if you go 360, the audience think they've done 360 before you've even come close to 360 with 2D. I know that I've got that going for me. And then set dressing, they came in and they were like, okay, we'll redress a little bit. So it looks different going out than it did coming in. Cool. Great. That's an example, though, of very tight. So I'm following Ray and Lorraine, but I cannot physically pan the camera when they turn a corner. It's too tight. I have to get out into the next narrow aisle before I can pan. Okay, got to have somebody. We have a chef. Yeah. Ray, why don't you do something with the chef? I had a personal relationship with each and every person in that room, every wipe, every tray move,
every busboy crossing your frame.
Absolutely. And I would work it out with them once I figured out the whole thing with Ray and he went away to get made up and everything. Then, yeah, I'll go through and with every single person, let's try that again. No, no, no. You got to be a little closer to lens. So let's try it again. No, I thought you were going to hit me. That was too close. Let's try it again. You know what? You're rushing. You should be in a hurry, but I don't want you rushing like you're getting out of my way. Right. Let's try it again. Many rehearsals, every single bit of that until we finally got out of the a big flurry of cross and then we into the club and woof, now there's dialogue. Not on me anymore. I just have to somehow figure out how to follow it. So we do things that I did that I really like doing. I want to be wide enough to see some of the action with the tables coming through and a little closer as they're sitting down, but I have to be able to pan over to see the Goombas with the bottle of wine or champagne or whatever. And now I want to be tighter to them, but I don't want to do a move into them. So I bury a little move sliding across a chair or something on the pan. So each pan, I get a little closer and then finally I'm in a nice frame that I like.
Nice.
While I'm doing all the choreography in the hall and down across the street, all that stuff, Michael's lighting that back room. And there are a ton of mirrors and lights everywhere. Every time I got a chunk of it figured out in the hallway, I would run in and look like, oh, Michael, hey, oh, guys, we need to flag that light off. Again, I wouldn't see it in the video. So I've got to nail the frames and know absolutely lights are out of the shot, reflections are out of the shot, flags aren't in the shot, and I have to be fucking precise too, on top of all that. So I was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So I'm videotaping some final rehearsals with Ray and Lorraine, and Marty is ready to come down and look at what we've done. Back then, it wasn't easy, but I had a little onboard recorder. Always have had an onboard recorder, always. rip apart a camcorder that I got in Tokyo and cut off the camera part. And, oh, yeah, it looks like I'm going to be a standalone recorder, whatever it took, and then play it back. Sound was recording the system. I had to work out a quick way to do, which from my filmmaking days at Cornell and Tumble, you know, independent filmmaking. Okay, let's just do a double system playback, right? So we show Marty a double system playback on my little Steadicam monitor, or maybe I was feeding a slightly larger monitor, and we watch it. And I'm like, okay, I've just taken over the film, the scene, and I've just directed the shit out of it with Ray. Ray was actually the director. He really was. Marty says, no! No! What? Oh, fuck me. Oh, no. Oh, no. What did I do? Oh, I shouldn't have. I never should have. Yeah. Oh. What is it? There's a lot of smoke, and he was having some problem with asthma, so he had a tank of oxygen.
Wow.
And no, you don't understand, Larry. My parents brought me to the club, and the thing that was so amazing, the thing that was like magic, was the table. When it appeared, it would just fly out of nowhere. Yeah. So you've got to let it fly into frame just like magic, and then you got to fly after it and follow it. I said, okay, Marty, we can do that. It's okay. Okay.
Deep breath.
Yes. So a little bit of change in the choreography. Okay. Why don't you come just a beat sooner? Let's try that. No, even sooner than that. And you know, make sure that that's just right and all the way down. Okay. So we did like, again, 7 or 8 takes. I don't know. Maybe we did a couple more, but I'm sure 7 or 8 was probably the one. I don't really remember, but that's the way it always was.
Did Youngman mess up his lines? Was that?
Well, there was a problem with any. So he didn't always come out when he should necessarily. And he didn't always get the lines out like he should. And it's at the end of this fucking long shot. So I said, Ray, you got to tell me when to look at the stage. You got to tell me when it's time. So that's what he does. To Lorraine, but he's doing it for me.
So when he points the stage, that's for you. Oh, cool.
That's for me.
Wow.
As if it was to Lorraine. And then they had to cut out early, I think, because a line went wrong or something. I wasn't in the editing room, but I think it's why we cut early overlap. You see the video from the airport heist. I mean, a capper of the story is that we broke for lunch. Then we came back and shot the rest of the scenes in the club. What? I mean, really, it's astonishing, don't you think? One day from rehearsing it, looking at it, lighting it, shooting it, everything, break for lunch, come back and shoot the second half of our night. When you do long shots, and it's appropriate for a long shot, it doesn't just tell the story better, way better. And the actors interact with each other, but it's fucking efficient, too. Yeah. How long would it have taken to shoot that conventionally? We'd be there several days.
And you're stuck with the characters. There's no escaping when you're watching a one take. For this sequence, you're traveling through the exclusive backdoor access to this gangster lifestyle.
Yes.
You are whisked through the line and right to the front row.
That's Marty's brilliance. I mean, that's what it's about. It was his. I suspect, I never thought about it until, again, many years later, maybe he was just going to do one of those voiceovers for that one. That's why he was going to do it that way. But then I created a whole other thing, so...
And the irony that became your most famous shot just is unbelievable.
Yeah, and I tell you the truth, I was worried for years that it was gimmicky maybe to do these long takes. What's the value in it? I mean, I knew it was thrilling for me and it was exciting as hell and it made sense dramatically to me. And the other part of it, which is maybe even the most significant, is the entire crew understood what we were doing. They knew what was in frame, what wasn't, what mattered, what didn't. And they also understood responsibilities. The ADs, the extras, everybody got it. Nobody wants to let down everybody else. No one can make a mistake. And maybe we can make it better. So everybody has suggestions. So it's the most fun, collaborative kind of filmmaking I think I've ever experienced is doing those long single takes.
Can't get enough of those type of stories. I do have 2 quick follow-up things about the Coppola shot. Have you ever seen the movie Swingers?
Yeah.
No. Now you gotta admit that the Steadicam shot in Goodfellas was the money.
The basement of the restaurant.
The Copa in New York.
Through the kitchen.
Yeah, I heard it took them 4 days to light for that shot.
4 days?
I don't know about 4 days.
Well, that's what I heard.
Well, they had to hide all the lights.
Jesus, that must have cost a fortune.
Do you remember that movie where they have like a whole segment where they talk?
I remember a whole
thing. Yeah, they talk about the Copacabana sequence being like the greatest Steadicam shot ever. And then in the following shot, they have them going through this club and there's like no human traffic. It's poorly lit and it's handheld. It's a cheap knockoff, but that's the comedy of it. I just didn't know if you had seen that before.
Yeah. But also, filmmakers, I was asked to come in on another film and redo it. We do it? Yeah, we have a couple hours. What? It was a lot of work to make it work. It should look like nothing happened. Magic carpet ride. That's the way I imagine it in my head. The audience is coming with me. You're just kind of moving through space and seeing what we want to see, when we want to see it. And it just happens.
Whenever you hear the song, Then He Kissed Me.
Then he kissed me.
Do you always think you're shot when you hear that song?
I guess I do.
I do.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Silence of the Lambs from 1991 with Jonathan Demme and director of photography Tak Fujimoto.
Catherine Martin!
Yes!
FBI! You're safe!
Safe chicken! Yeah!
I definitely want to talk about the Buffalo Bill bunker shots. The first time we see Bill's bunker, you maneuver through his butterfly cages, past his costumes, past him sewing naked, and into the pit where Catherine Martin is being held captive. And then there's just some other amazing sequences in there where at one point, like Buffalo Bill's dog gets taken captive and he's running and you're leading him and hauling ass through his underground lair. I mean, can you talk about being part of some of the most terrifying shots of all film history?
Is it really?
Yes.
When you're doing it, being kind of analytical about it, and this should work, but I'm not scared when I'm doing it so much. Except for one part of it. Logistically, it was daunting. Partly, you had to have the death moth. What was it called? You know?
Adirondacks or something like that. I can't remember the name of it.
Particular type of butterfly that was being bred just for this scene. Timing was everything. You have to bring them in when they're ready to take first flight. And Moth Wrangler told us it will only happen within a couple of degrees of temperature. A little colder, a little warmer. And we were in a warehouse. It wasn't a stage. It was a warehouse to put sets in. So they had an enormous kerosene heater that would blast because it was cold. That would and blast through the whole warehouse and raise the temperature. And then the Moth Wrangler would be like, okay, they're starting to come. Kill it, kill it. Roll, roll, roll. So it's a lot of that trying to get the moths actually flying. In the end, needed one specific one to really sell it. And we ended up having to use a monofilament and have it placed in the frame just right. So there was that whole thing. I remember with Jonathan really admiring or respecting what he had done before and the sensitivity of his films and the quiet respect for things. And I got there the day ahead for my scene. So I thought, well, I'm all unpacked. Everything's right. I'll go out to set, hang out. And I walk in and it's the scene where Sir Anthony Hopkins, he's just broken out and killed. And he's coming down the elevator and there's blood dripping down. And I see a figure crouched down. Whoa, watching a monitor. Oh yeah, more blood though, more blood. I'm like, what? That's sort of passionate about whatever he does, but it was like, oh my God, what have I got myself into? What is this film? I mean, I read script, I knew, but still, I was kind of shocked by that. Next day, it's my turn, and we have, as you saw, all the shots, so we pretty well shot in sequence. So we did the first stuff with Wild Buffalo Bill, crazy man, who really, yeah, he exuded something unnatural about him and unhuman about him. So I didn't have to fake anything. But yeah, we went around, follow a little dog, find her down in the pit and looking down and all that stuff. But the real problem came, it was all down to the final scene with Jody. I think the first scene I did with her was a shower scene. I'm in there with her with the Steadicam, and she's doing a shower and we have to show, but not too much. And then the phone. And she said, you know what? This is ridiculous. If you guys take your tops off, I'll take mine off. That was like my first introduction to Jody.
What?
Done. So sound man, focus pole, we all pull our shirts off. We're in the shower with her and we shoot the scene. So much easier than not seeing that little wisp of a piece of cloth or anything. So that was Jody. So there was immediate trust bonding. Yeah. Like, we're in this together. We're supporting each other. We're doing what we can for each other, right? That's what we're here for. That really came as a great aid when we went to the big scene, which everybody understood. It was in the script. And everybody said, okay, the lights go out and she's in the dark and our villain can see her through the night vision. But how are we going to do that? Puck said, don't worry about it. We'll just frame it. A little higher contrast lighting, but I mean, we're going to do it later. You don't have to do anything different. You know, I mean, you have to embody the POV. We get to the point all the way through where you see that horrible, grotesque bathtub, like whatever's left, and then the lights come out. I can now see everything. Jody can see everything. Everybody can see everything. The lights are still on. And Jody's like, doesn't know how to do it. So I talk to her. Well, Jody, close your eyes and imagine and relax. When you open it up, you'll see your eyes are probably a little out of focus, maybe crossed, whatever. Try to maintain that same sense of not being able to see anything. So I direct her.
You're giving Jodie Foster acting tips?
Yes, because we're working together. We're feeding off each other. And when I come in close, I know you can see me, but don't. Maybe you sense a breath or you hear something different, but I'm going to be very careful and very quiet. Something clicks for her, boom, and suddenly she's doing it. And it's magnificent. I say, you can sweep your eyes through the camera, just don't stop on them. Don't focus. Try to be everything out of focus. So you have no idea where I am. And then work with Ted to figure out the ways that he can reach in. So we have to work together. First one hand and then the other. We go in together. We're one person. You start your hand and I'll follow it. So you get there first and then I'll start to draw back and then you follow me. And so we do this little dance. And on the other side, I've got to like do it across my body. Very awkward. Not a natural Steadicam move at all. It was that symbiosis of the three of us.
Wow.
Doing this dance that was mind-tingling. So there, yes, even though the lights were on for all of us, I did feel like, ooh. And Jody was like magical to do that. That isn't easy. I don't know other films people have had to do that.
I don't either, but I will definitely say watching her performance, I think you shot that on infrared cameras. That's what I'm thinking. That's why actually what I was wondering to see what you would say during the storytelling.
Nope.
Yeah, her performance is so good.
Little lighting change, and later in post to put the frame that's like his. Mm-hmm. Big lighting change, especially looking at him. So you see nothing but that backlit kind of edge of goggles and shit. And he was magnificent to work with. So when I'm with him, I am him. Even though I'm looking at him, I'm still him. Because it can't be Jody's POV. So clearly it has to be somehow different from Jody's. So I have to be with him. We are one entity. Yes. He might get a little closer to me, but basically I'm an extension of him in some weird way. Ted was great. Jody was great. I was good too. Spooky.
All right, let's move on to 1999 Summer of Sam. Director Spike Lee and director of photography Terrence Blanchard. The shot I want to touch base on is the John Leguizamo nightclub oneer. This shot begins with you hoisted up in the air on a crane, then follows a muscle car, and then transitions into a Steadicam follow of Leguizamo and Mira Sorvino into a club, and ends in a dance routine. Tons of elements to cover here.
That was fun, too. It used to be, there was always the big motherfucking crane. God damn it. The big one. The truck-mounted, mercury-ballasted, self-leveling Titan crane. For a while, that was the only one that anybody would allow or Steadicam operators would permit to be used for the hoist up into space and come back down. Since then, we've learned grips, particularly as Steadicam operators, how to safely use smaller cranes, lighter cranes, because there weren't that many of these Titans. But there was one always in New York at that point. So had that going for me. The big part for Steadicam and for a lot of stuff I'm doing on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel as well, how do you blend something like a crane shot into a Steadicam? And so it's the transition, which is everything. So what I've done with the Titan, able to have the grips build me as low as possible and as long as possible, like an extra tongue. an extra piece of heavy-duty plywood that stands out a little bit. Because what I want to do is, as I get close, there's somebody up with me, which is another thing. With the Titan, you can have somebody else riding with me, holding on to me, safetying me. But as it's about to touch down, just tell him, do not give me a soft kiss-off, because that's not the shot. I'll do the kiss-off with the Steadicam. Hit it. Don't slow down. Just go. And in the middle of that, I'm stepping away from the safety rail and everything, and it hits, and I'm already halfway off the crane, and then I just let the momentum carry me, carry it high. It hits, and the Steadicam carries, and my momentum walking down the plank, nice wide plank, 4x8 plywood usually, but I'm walking the plank and hitting it. That way you can eliminate any transition.
Okay.
It's just one swoop. So that's a big thing. It's those little technical details that allow magic to happen. Because if you don't attend to all those little details, even with the extras like I talked about and all that. So car comes and I'm looking, and then a strict point grips know how to do it. And they magically get me down the right time and follow the car in. And we want a big wide, or I do, big wide scene, because it's going to take time for them to get out of the car and do a tip, maybe. Spike was completely also just like, do it. I wanted to stay wider. And then we had the long line that they're bypassing, and then join with them. And then into the club and all the way through, and then do the dance. So it was all tightly choreographed until they got to the dance floor. And then we just improvised. Just flow, flow, baby, flow. But by then, I had many music documentaries, a lot of them with dancing, performers even dancing with their saxes or something too. But it was just like coming back, coming back to my roots.
All right, the last director we're going to touch base on is Quentin Tarantino and his director of photography, Robert Robert Richardson.
Whoa! Boy, this is a motherlode now.
Tarantino is usually so dialogue-heavy in his movies. Kill Bill, for me, was really the first time I began to notice his ability to move cameras so skillfully. You've worked with him and Robert on Kill Bill and Django Unchained. I want to touch base on 2003's Kill Bill 1, specifically.
It was one movie.
That's true. Sorry, you're right. The whole bloody affair is one movie.
Everything.
That's correct.
One movie.
I stand corrected. So the shot I want to talk about is the House of Blue Leaves one-er.
Oh, yeah.
It's just shy of 3 minutes. You're following the bride and then the character they call Charlie Brown and the villainess Sophie all around the layout of the House of Blue Leaves. And it's timed out to the song because you have to hit an exact beat with the lead singer, the 5-6-7-8s. Somehow you manage to go up and over some kind of wall that separates you and the bride. You do another one of your angles. Again, you kill the head. The headroom is perfect as you boom back down.
Anamorphic.
Oh my God. Talk me through this shot, man, because I watched it again just last night and I showed my girlfriend and I'm freaking out. I'm like, look at this effing shot, man. It's like, I don't know how he does this shit, but it's fucking perfect. So please talk me through it.
You're a great critic. Yeah. Appreciate that.
You love critics to say it's fucking perfect.
Yeah. And I'll tell you why it wasn't. But yeah, that started, I'd already worked with Bob. We're a pretty seasoned team by then. He can be very aggressive and domineering, and he hates it when somebody else is shooting. hates it, because he is an extraordinary operator, and he's worked out with his team. His grip's fucking awesome. Mostly crane on track with the bob seat, which swivels around, that lets him go all the way around, keeping his eye to the eyepiece, and just being one with the camera. So to have somebody else operate is like mind-blowingly wrong for him. But there wasn't any question if Quentin wanted this longer shots, he wanted me to do it. And originally he said, okay, Soleri, there's this film I'm going to do with Quentin. There's two shots that we want you to come in and do. Probably be able to arrange it so you can do both, you know, at the same time, and then you go home. It'll be in China.
That's awesome, by
okay.
the way.
I see. Okay. Now, both shots are 10 minutes long. Whoa. I can't do 10 minute long. I mean, it's film. And my MovieCam Compact, the most perfect camera for Steadicam ever, has vertical mag. And so there's a slight change top bottom CG, but it's masked by the overall CG of the Steadicam. Mm-hmm. So it's perfect, stays perfect all the way. To put a 1,000 foot mag on would mean it would be way back heavy. So the only way to compensate, because the back would hit the front of, you know, the back of the Steadicam. So now you've got to push everything forward on the bottom sled, and it would be the most massively out of balance. Those who don't know, you can have perfect static balance, and if you pan it and it's not dynamically balanced, it will try to do a violent 45-degree roll as you pan. See, it can't be done, Bob. Can't do it. Sorry. No. I said, no, I'm telling you. And I said, well, there's this new camera. Aries just come out. Do you know anything about it? No. He says, well, it's supposed to be really light. Check it out. So I went in. I forget which house it was back then for Aries. So they brought it out. And they had a 1,000-foot mag. They said, you know, we have this thing that we use, especially for handheld, and it cocks the magazine, like about 45-degree angle. Maybe that would help you? Yeah, bring it up. And I think a dummy load that they had so I could see with the weight. And much to my surprise, if I slid it up just about a quarter inch shy of the top of my Steadicam top stage, it balanced. And also to my shock, it was the same weight as my MovieCam Compact with 500 foot loads in my 500 foot magazine. Oh, shit. Okay. I'm not going to tell Bob I can do it. Like, all right. I got that information. Okay, we may talk. He has always used Panavision. So to move to Airflex is a huge deal for him, too. So then I went home, and my body was timed for 4, maybe 5 minutes, and then it would give out. That's what I did. So I had to start practicing how can I last for a 10-minute shot. And I put on the Steadicam, and I trudged from my shop up a little incline to where our horse barn was. And I turn around and back away down or try different things sideways, everything. And I get like 6 minutes. Okay, that's it. Okay. And after a 2-week period, I got up to 10 minutes. I did it. Back then, younger, my body would take on conditioning, you know, pretty quickly. Hey, Bob, I can do it. Yeah, really? Oh, don't worry about it, Larry. We're going Panavision, so you don't have to do it. I have to do 5 minutes max. Shit. Yeah, it was another challenge that I successfully and didn't pay off to anything.
I would love to see the Larry McConkey training montage sometime.
Oh, God. So then I felt like really capable of extraordinary things. So I started to talk to Herb Alts, the key grip, because he then described the shot to me. Yeah, so you're going to be under the stairs, and then her feet are going to come down in, and then she's going to get low enough to see who it is. And then she goes around behind this translucent kind of a curtain. It's a thing where you'll see it through. And then you go up and over that. And then you go, whoa, Bob, what? How do I go over? What do you mean? I don't know, Larry. Talk to Herb. You'll work something out. So you go over and then, you know, drop down into the bathroom and fuck me. So I'm like, how the fuck are we going to do that? And I talked to Herb and he said, well, we've been thinking about that. I've been working with a company that does for a warehouse, moving things from A to B. It'll go up. It'll go over. It'll go down. And in fact, they started out with a 2-axis because really it had to go over and then follow down the, so it had to have a little zigzag too. And he had his guy, a master electronics engineer and everything else, mechanical, everything. And he worked with a company that built these things. They had to program new firmware to make camera move out of this conveyance. So how do I do it? So we started exchanging sketches like that. Graphic, there's a guy sitting on a crescent moon fishing, I think. Is that right?
The DreamWorks logo?
So, yeah, how about that? So from the top, you'd support, but then it'll go around big enough radius that I can swivel around a swiveling seat, need a platform so I can pan. What do you think? Yeah, okay. So we exchanged some more drawings, and they made one out of steel, which weighed hundreds of pounds. I would rig something in my shop to like pretend, okay, it should be this. Okay, this needs to, I need to have 3 feet behind the center of gravity where the seat is. So I show up in China with all my tools too, just in case. And we look at the rig and it looks good. It says the only problem is plugged it in over there and it went up in smoke.
Whoa.
Because over there they had reverse polarity in the whole stage from conventional international standards. So this is a unique box that had blown up. What are we going to do? I don't know. Managed to reprogram another box the same way. And that guy who did it flew it over with him. So then we were finally able to start moving it. And using the lens, again, I think it was probably a 30 millimeter lens that looked like it would do everything, we got up and over, and it wasn't wide enough to see into the kitchen, because just like Michael Bauhaus, you have to see the kitchen. He made it really wildly different green color. I said, you got to get that, Larry. You got to see that. Hey, Herb, what? It's got to go up 3 feet. You know, rigging up in the rafters, everything. Buying time, Quentin, I think, was shooting other scenes while we tried to get this together to hurry. This was a massive shot when we sketched it out with Quentin, because there was that daunting part that I had to engineer with Herb. But we wanted to be able to shoot, as you saw, across the group, want to really see them. And I had them do a little move, and I walk with them, and then they stop, and it becomes Uma coming down. And then I follow her. We're seeing the entire club. Then up and over. That wasn't easy. Also, I had to have a rig. I think maybe they just use a C-stand or something, but to help steer it besides me, to navigate it through so I didn't hit. Because a couple times I hit. Like, I'm up in the air, dangling from the thing, and bang, whoa!
Oh, whoa.
So they had to, like, carefully guide me through that and drop me down. But while that happened, when we came back out of the kitchen, the idea was to be on a crane so we could go up and see Quentin's old girlfriend coming down the stairs. I had to have a crane up here, but it couldn't be anywhere in the set. This is China. A lot of things are done with lots of people. So we had a gigantic part of the set that would pull out of the way, enormous wooden wedge of a ramp carried down by like 20 guys, put in place, roll the crane down, get it in a position while we're doing our little thing in the bathroom. And then there's going to be this long down the hallway. And I'm thinking, shoe leather again, shoe leather. Oh, shit. No, no, no. Quentin, we got to have something to follow or in front. I think we should be in front. Well, okay. And so he's great at improvising too. So he decides to use the club making view. You know, they got to be talking to each other somehow, right, Quentin? Yeah. So he writes some dialogue, lecturing somebody. So now we've got this scene to follow, which, by the way, led to Quentin thinking she was good with that. So he then wrote her into other scenes later on, because it was a one shot before, but now she's got a role. So once we come out, I wanted to get back to the singer, but the stage was like 15 feet away. That sucks. I want to see the whole, I want to see a close up of her singing, especially to help mask the move to a crane. I'm down the hallway. She turns, it goes up. I went, boom, singing. There's a koi pond in between me and the stage. More Chinese crew, and they bring this huge platform and cover the koi pond and then bring the microphone. And I think they had a little bar stool for her or something so that she could be right there. Like, boom, there she is. And then up the crane and then back down. And I know at one point Bob was like, Larry, this seems like too much. This doesn't look like this is going to work. Maybe we should just, no, Bob, we're going to do the crane. I'm like invested in this. And it worked. But to guide me onto that little seat, because it's a lightweight crane, it had a pretty good boom range, but it's light. I really got to hit a very narrow window with my special seat, but still. So I wanted tape marks on the floor to lead me very precisely. Always do that little arrowing down to the point where I'm going to hit the crane. But they would be visible in the previous shot. So I had to have the tape marks put down by the Chinese crew. They got it nailed. They're going to put it down. They have little reference marks, and they have the tape ready, and it's tacked up against a set wall where he wouldn't see it. Wow. And then they'll pull it down. But the set was built supposedly at Japan. I actually looked at shooting this whole thing in Japan and realized it would cost four times or something. It was like too much. So Quentin wanted all the Japanese set builders to come to China. So they did.
Wow.
And they built that set traditional manner. I remember I was shocked. I smelled something burning and I went stage next to the main one. And one of the Japanese had a blowtorch and he was burning, essentially getting the sap to rise out of these big wooden beams.
Whoa.
And then it comes out and it kind of caramelizes. It kind of burns. And that's the finish. So that preserves the wood. It looks beautiful. I was like, shit. So that whole set was like built for real with the Japanese. And the Japanese and the Chinese have traditionally had wars. And there's still animus, which is something that Quentin loves. Conflict, this is deal. So he was happy to have them at war with each other a little bit. It just added to the emotional intensity of everything. And when they saw the Chinese crew put tape up on their set, which they had handcrafted, they went ballistic and a fight broke out.
Whoa.
And all the ADs, the Chinese AD particularly, broke it up. And then Quentin came out, and I can't remember what he said, but Quentin loves a lot of different people in his movies. And so we had four or five different nationalities in various departments, including the crew. So characteristically, at the very beginning, which I didn't know yet, he announced to the crew, okay, so this is the movie we're going to make. And I just wanted to tell you some things about it. And then he had a translator for the Japanese, a translator for the Chinese, translator for Spanish. I forgot how many languages, three or four. And then he'd go on. And I couldn't believe he was taking this amount of time, this amount of care to let us all understand. Because most movies, you don't. You may be able to read the script, but you don't get it. So he wanted everybody to share and understand. He took a lot of time doing that. But wow, this is different. So anyway, peace was to be found somehow, coming up with a compromise, and they took the tape and carefully kind of made it just barely tacky enough. So when they put it up, it would not pull off anything. So wild. It was wild.
What an insane behind the scenes story. I've never heard that before about Kill Bill. That's crazy.
Yeah. And then there was blood.
Lots of blood.
A lot of blood. Quentin had been down this road many times before with the censorship ratings, and he knew the level of bloodletting he was going to have in the big, huge battle scene there, slaughter scene, that they wouldn't pass. They would give it like an X rating, I guess it would have been. And the difference he had calculated or already worked out, I can't remember how much planning went into it. But if the American version went to black and white, it would pass. And for the rest of the world, if it was in color and all that blood, it would be really cool. The problem was, for special effects he'd worked with before, especially on blood, you got to make up a blood that will work just as well in black and white as it will in color. No Hershey syrup, great black and white blood. Got to work both. And they spent a lot of time, and they finally engineered something that worked and was not toxic to have it in mouths and things. And then they made several hundred gallons of it for the film.
That's Greg Nicotero doing all that stuff, man.
Used.
Silly rabbit. Tricks are for kids.
Do you have a preferred camera you've worked with before?
Movie Camp Compact, which was then my camera. Although it was basically a lease arrangement to Ted's brother, Jack. So for many years, until digital started to take over. And I finally, after 3 years not using it, I gave it back to Jack and immediately got calls for a film. But in the meantime, Harry. So I bought a Mini. And I mostly bought the Mini for movie work, actually. But that became my digital camera. Although I've had them all, especially the big monster motherfuckers that we started with. Yeah. Unbelievable big pigs of digital. That was a rough transition.
Wonners have been around for decades. Orson Welles famously kicked off Touch of Evil with a Wonner that has still marveled audiences to this day. Do you feel directors are overusing Wonners these days as a way to show off instead of servicing the story?
There's always that danger. Overusing Steadicam, overusing handheld, overusing anything. Famous example, I think, was handheld. Commercials never used to have ever handheld. And boy, I should know the name of the director who was also a cameraman who did the first, at least big budget commercial for United States Television handheld. And it was flawless. It was beautiful. It was amazing. Everybody started to copy it. And it was horrible. It's just horrible handheld work. So they're copying the idea, the notion of it, but not the heart and soul of it. So that's happened over and over and over again.
Do you ever go see your work with an audience in a theater?
I have. I mean, lately that's not happening. But when I started film study at Cornell and I began to look critically at how to frame, light, edit, it destroyed me because I could no longer enjoy movies. There was a 2-year period where I could not watch a film without watching how it was done. And it broke that magic and ruined it. Finally, I was able to put the two together and I was able to appreciate technically how it was done. And then sometimes I could just watch and enjoy the film. And I didn't even, hey, did you notice how they, no,
yeah.
Really? I'll go look at that again. And in a similar way, when I was watching things I'd done and there was an audience there, I was very self-conscious about how they respond to the shot. Did they think that was stupid? Did they? Oh, they seem to like it.
That's what I was going to ask. Do you ever have like movie nerds in your audiences that you can kind of tell they're whispering to each other like, I think this is still one shot. They haven't cut.
Hopefully not. I do not remember.
Because you don't
that,
like bringing attention to it.
That,
gotcha.
Then it's not working. That I failed.
Gotcha.
But after that Copacabana shot and a year after maybe, and I'm still worried about like doing these things. And is it just to show off? Is it a gimmick? Cab driver. What do you do? Oh, I work in a film business. Really? What do you do? Oh, I'm a cameraman. Oh, yeah? Yeah, I operate a Steadicam. I don't know if you Steadicam. Oh, yeah. Goodfellas. That was a great shot. So I did it. Really? Did you like it? Oh, it was awesome. It was great. That suddenly broke the ice for me. Like, okay, somehow there's something of value doing this. That some people even see, even recognize how it was done, but really like it.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite piece of music that's been layered over your work? And it doesn't have to be song. It can be score.
Rarely is music played while shooting, except for my introduction to Scorsese, or I'm doing a music concert or something. Generally, I find the rhythm and the music, and I am thinking in terms of phraseology when I'm shooting. There's no question I'm bringing a visual music to how I shoot, which was all classical. I only played classical music on the piano. So that's carried through. Classical music is very precise, and it builds and it ebbs and it flows, and it's aiming from A to B. A lot of more modern music is just kind of noise, or it's just distracting like handheld camera. I'm building musical phrases and sensibilities into the mood, lyrical. But then I'm going to shock somebody for a second. That's a punctuation.
Yeah. I think Patrick Doyle music during Carlito's Way, especially that last half hour. Oh my God, that's just
and
amazing.
We had no idea about that shooting it.
You must have gone and seen the finished product and thought, man, this matches your work, because it does.
Oh yeah, I didn't even notice it.
So good.
That's the high water mark.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully people didn't notice how I shot it either. Just watched the actors having trouble negotiating the subway. And I didn't fall. Moving train, although everybody like, whoa, it wasn't easy.
I think when people think of De Palma or his branding, they think of his collaborators. Burham, you got Nancy Allen, you got Pino Donaggio, and you and your intense camera moves. What's your thoughts on creating your own legacy while helping define another artist's legacy?
First of all, filmmaking is collaborative, and that's why it's so great to be involved in it. No one person can have total control and have it be anything worthwhile. You can have a vision, a leader, an orchestrator, and De Palma, for instance, is that. He's a great orchestrator, and he's always watching, but he wants everybody to do their part in the orchestra. He doesn't want to have to be telling you how to play the notes or shit. You know, there's a script. It lays out basic goal, and we all find our way to support each other to do it. I've always been fearful, especially with the tool like Steadicam, which when it came out, especially, it was like, what is this? I did not want to take over, although I did take over. I didn't want to take over and make it, there's a film, and then suddenly it stains with Quentin, too, especially. Hong Kong, particularly fight films, a director would direct the film until the fight scene. Then he would walk away, leave the set, and the fight director come in. And in fact, he had a fight director from Hong Kong come with his fight team when he was first choreographing fight scenes. And he would show us then, and we'd all be watching. And went and say, cool. But, and the fight director was like, whoa. But, you know, that shot you're saying here? Yeah. But I think we should have a close-up of the blade and then a one back here, close-up of the eyeball, and then some blood dripping, and then this and that. And he would make it five times as dense. And the Hong Kong director, very proud of what he was doing, and his all his actors, like, and he would come on board with Quentin's vision because it just amplified what he was doing. Same way for me as a Steadicam operator, Quentin would amplify what I could do and give me that room. One amazing moment leading up to those fight scenes, Uma goes to get the special sword.
The Hatari Hanzo.
Oh, so as I'm starting to shoot this, where interaction between the two, it's not a fight scene. It's a very quiet. Quentin says, listen, Larry, just so you know, the picture behind him, that's his dad, okay? And he learned everything from his father, right? I don't want you to feature it or anything. I just want you to know. Okay. Wow. Okay. Okay. So he would treat me as an actor, essentially. I'm just another actor acting for the audience. I was worried about taking over, like a fight director would come in and do it. I wanted to blend in and not have an obvious change. So I'm very sensitive to the way a film is being shot and the director and his intent. And for people like Quentin, he would bring me into some embrace. There wasn't ever a worry about that.
Mm-hmm. I have one more follow-up Copacabana question. It's the shot you're most famous for. Do you believe it's your greatest shot?
It was one of the first successful, how do I solve this puzzle? But you already mentioned there was a shot, well, introducing all the gangsters.
Yeah.
And what was great about that is I went in with Marty, and I think we just had stand-ins. And so he said, so here it is. And he read what would end up being Ray's voiceover. And so we go through, I said, well, it's a little rushed, right? Let's pull him back. Let's bring him forward. Let's try it again. And the two of us were leading each other through those shots. You know what? What if he turns? He could toast or something, right? So the two of us worked out the choreography with him providing the rhythm, the words. That's what made that so sweet, so special. So then when we had the actors come in, it was like a done deal. But it was Marty's rhythm and two of us collaborating. And that was perfect, I thought. And then the other great shot, and I think I mentioned to you one, and I cannot remember exactly, but in Carlito's Way, and Garrett pointed this out to me. I didn't think anybody in the world would notice what I was doing. But the pivotal scene between Al and Penelope, walking and talking, ends up with the police coming up. It's just a simple walk and talk. I hate walk and talks, generally. Unless there's something magical about it that can happen. And so that was one we worked out together. They were brilliant. Oh, Al. At being closer and then far away, going off the sidewalk, back on. I mean, it was just, it ended up being this perfect blending of choreography and acting and rhythm. Like I said, with Al, we didn't have to talk about it. We really didn't. He got me. I got him.
You're in sync.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Garrett thought that was the best shot he'd ever seen or I'd done.
Well, if Garrett says it, that's probably your best shot then.
Exactly.
In the past, you've said your drive to create amazing shots stems from your need to support the Steadicam and its legacy. Can you explain a bit more on why you have such a sense of pride for a piece of equipment?
Well, it allowed me to finally do what I was always achingly trying to do somehow, doing handheld work. And I got into a little bit of dolly finally. But it was an elusive goal. It was a dream I had of how a shot could happen. I desperately wanted it to happen. And then somebody made it for me. Who knew? Wow.
In the same state you were living, too.
Well, I didn't know. And that's worth mentioning. A couple years in, and I was still working mostly local Philadelphia. I was working TV news, a couple of stations. CBS ended up their station. They covered the Mummer's Parade. Anybody doesn't know what the Mummer's Parade is, Philadelphia? You're missing something in your life. It was extraordinary. And they would have live broadcasts. Some station would. CBS had it that time. And I had a great supporter who was a mutual friend of Garrett's. I had Ware now that he was in the city probably. I did a live, and that wasn't easy because the umbilical cables were huge and had to work out a way for somebody to help me pan the camera, but was able to craft shots that nobody had seen before. And my confederate, Damon Sinclair, acted like my producer for the station for me doing it. And I would come up with a shot that looked good. And I was able to talk to Damon, and Damon said, yeah, I'm going to sell it. And he would tap the director and say, Larry's got a great shot. And I had to be thinking ahead for the next shot, because by the time he recognized and thought it was great, it was gone. So I had to think two shots in a row, one to entice, bait the hook, and then one to. So Garrett saw it and thought, wow, there's finally somebody who gets it. How does he get it? Why does he get it? How can I make him better? So through Damon, he invited me to his house to do what I think was the first Steadicam workshop. The rules are, Larry, don't hit the chandelier, you're both dead. Don't scrape the wall, you're dead. It was a tight little townhouse and some stairs and stuff. And he did this magical thing, which I've carried to the end of time with me now, my career, about Steadicam. I was struggling a bit, especially not worried about not hitting things. He said, you know what, let's turn off the monitor just so you're not distracted. And we're transmitting and recording. And I said, okay, That made it easier. Now I can see if I was going to hit the wall or chandelier, and I can kind of point the camera where it should be. I see the stairs. I understand that it should lift up, and then I can boom it down. You know, all this stuff. And we looked at it, and it was so much better.
Wow.
Headroom was better. Framing was fucking on. It was, like, way better. And that's when I realized, as I was mentioning early on, I think, that the job of a Steadicam operator is to be able to move it through space and time to be in the right place at the right time to support the story, whatever. And if you got a monitor, that'll help with the last little bit. But you really need to know I'm doing this and that and this. Garrett deemed that worthy of his attention to teach. And then workshops were developed. And I swear, it took me 2 years to get to the level that in those first workshops, we got guys who hadn't done it before in 1 week. They got to where it took me 2 years to get with the skills and everything. The workshops are extraordinary. They've gotten better and better. We get better at teaching them. We learn. Yes, we see struggle students. Say, oh, yeah, that is right. Yeah. And the great thing about Steadicam, Garrett started it. He was overwhelmingly generous with making us all as good as we could be. Not for his sake, maybe for the legacy of Steadicam, which gets back to your question, but to make us all better, as good as he can make it. And that has become a tradition, kind of a custom, a culture among Steadicam operators. We all try to share anything we can with anybody in the community who needs it.
Larry, thank you so much. You've been so generous with your time. Go back and have a good time on your vacation. I really appreciate you going through all your famous shots. I could have talked to you for another 5 hours because there's so much more to cover, but I think we did a pretty good little sampling of some of your more important work. So I can't thank you enough, sir.
Thank you. And then we got to go to Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Steadicam and Movie, because I've been way into that shit now.
Anytime you're ready for an interview part two, you let me know, sir. But I can't thank you enough. You've been very generous. Again, go enjoy the beach, sir. Have a great day.
I'm out of here.
There it is, people. Season one of Sidetracked is officially in the can. Big thanks to all our friends here who made this year and a half an amazing run. Huge, huge thanks to producer Gigi Lage, who does way more work than I do on this show. I get to do all the fun stuff while she does all the heavy lifting. If you're enjoying what you're hearing from us so far, feel free to leave us a review. The positive feedback goes a long way. Check us out on our social media sites like Instagram and Facebook. And if you want to stay current on any upcoming episodes, go to our official website at sidetrack.stream. We're going to take a tiny break, but we'll be back even better and louder with season two. Until then, we love you all and stay sick.